This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The last time you were on, about a year ago, you had said essentially at that point that the only thing that could save us was an immediate cessation of all industrial activity. How much further do we have to go now?
I strongly suspect that because of those positive feedbacks, even completion of the ongoing collapse will not prevent near-term human extinction as a result of climate change. A scenario that would involve geoengineering and complete collapse and 27 other miracles that you might come up with that would actually allow our species to persist beyond another human generation.
That is Dr. Guy McPherson speaking on Mike Rupert's Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, April 21st, 2013. Are you living in the last human generation? Now that the 2012 Mayan calendar craze is over, there is a new movement claiming we are heading into near-term human extinction. One group says the Northern Hemisphere will be devoid of people by the 2030s, with the population of the Southern Hemisphere dying out a few years later. Why? Due to a combination of events caused by climate change. The Arctic will release very high levels of methane gas, they say. It will come from frozen methane on the shallow seabed, now exposed by the end of the sea ice, and from the land, from rotting vegetation frozen over the ages in the permafrost, now released. Methane is at least 20 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. For a few years, it may be as much as 100 times more powerful. If a lot of methane is released in a decade or two, global mean temperature may rise more than 10 degrees centigrade, some say. It could be twice that in the Arctic. Could our complex industrial civilization survive? It's unlikely agriculture could feed our current billions with the changes. Most current species would disappear in the sixth great extinction. Are humans immune to extinction? Is it happening already? Arctic sea ice is melting more each year. Should we try to cool the Arctic, if not the world? That's the view of a small but growing group of scientists and concerned citizens. It's called geoengineering. Most scientists caution we have not reached such a desperate stage yet. Geoengineering could just make things worse. It's never been done. We don't know the side effects. 2 weeks ago, we had the Australian author Clive Hamilton on Radio EcoShock. Clive explained the big risks of attempting to block out the sun called solar radiation management. In his book, Earthmasters, Hamilton describes a somewhat unholy alliance of billionaire Bill Gates, a small clique of worried and respected scientists, some nuclear weapons lab types, and some of the world's biggest oil and coal companies. They are all pushing geoengineering to cool the world. We are going to investigate near-term human extinction. We'll peer into one of the primary sources of this idea, Malcolm Light, from the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. You may find some of his solutions outrageous, but they have been presented, in all seriousness, to the British Parliament. The AMEG group wants geoengineering to start this year, in 2013. We'll hear who is spreading this ultimate climate despair. Some are people I respect, my friends. Others are from the fringe, the anonymous spaces of the Internet. It's a big mix as we encounter the strangest and most fearful prediction of human demise. Oh, and one more thing. I can't give you the final answer. We don't know yet, do we? In fact, as collapsnik Dmitry Orlov writes in his blog, we can never know whether we are extinct. Let's begin with that voice that tweaked my brain. My Radio EcoShock show for December 5th, 2012 was called On the Road to Extinction. It features a speech by Dr. Guy McPherson, delivered at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Kentucky. Guy, you will remember, is a qualified natural scientist who left the University of Arizona to pursue his own free speech. I wondered if the extreme statements Guy made about extreme global warming were true. I spent 2 days cross-checking pretty well everything he said. I posted my results online, his sources all checked out. But none of those scientific papers and authoritative reports said humans would go extinct before 2050. Guy McPherson made that jump, in part due to a frightening scientific-looking paper by one Malcolm Light. I'll get to that. These days, Guy's blog, Nature Bats Last, features stories like The Irreconcilable Acceptance of Near-Term Extinction by Daniel A. Drumright, and On the Acceptance of Near-Term Extinction by Gary Gripp, and Preparing for Near-Term Extinction by Carolyn Baker. These people explain how they came to accept that humans are done for, and soon. How do we cope with living in the end times? There are others, a growing chorus of others, and they take this belief very seriously, as if it is already proved by science and by developments in the real world. I disagree. We are all entitled to an opinion. The future, by definition, is not known. Despite all the very real dangers we face in climate change, industrial poisons, hundreds of unstable nuclear reactors, a fossil-powered civilization past its best-before date, I think humans will still be around, trying to survive a continually warming world for hundreds of years, if not more. Shortly, I'll explain why. We'll hear about the long human history of end times thinking from popular author and commentator John Michael Greer. I've got a Radio EcoShock reading from a new book by Asoka Bandaraji about current trends of extinction in Aboriginal peoples. Author John Cox wonders if we might choose extinction. We'll hear a clip from Dr. David Archer from the University of Chicago. But first, let's hear those who worry we won't last more than a generation. We'll start with another clip of Dr. Guy McPherson, again on PRN, this time with network founder and longtime radio broadcaster Gary Null.
But I've been studying climate change, and I've seen one paper, one refereed journal article in my career so far that suggests we need to eliminate this set of living arrangements in order to prevent runaway greenhouse. And that was a paper by Tim Garrett at the University of Utah that appeared in the prestigious journal Climatic Change in 2009. So now almost 4 years ago, we have a paper that points out the only hope for preventing runaway climate change is complete collapse. It's among the most important and least cited papers I've ever come across in my career. And when I ask graduate students, postdocs, people who are at the height of their career in terms of their knowledge of literature, when I ask them, they've never heard of that author, they've never heard of that paper. It's buried. Like so many of the important things, it's buried by the culture. It just can't creep out through the stagnant layer of information or misinformation that is this culture. Let me give you the bottom line with respect to climate change. Oliver Tickell synthesized a bunch of research in a 2008 article in The Guardian, the London newspaper. And he concluded that on a planet 4 degrees hotter than baseline, all we can prepare for is human extinction. That was 5 years ago. According to BP's Energy Outlook 2030, which was published in January of this year, global average temperature of Earth will hit the 4 degree centigrade mark in 2030. Hmm. So we have triggered, on the climate front, almost certain human extinction in the relatively near term.
That's 17 years.
Yes, it is.
That's not a long time. That's not time to prepare for governments or countries. Individuals, it could.
That's right. And individuals can prepare to the extent they can move to some place or develop a set of living arrangements that allows them to live a little bit longer. But 17 years is not a long time. And even if we buy into the literature from mainstream climate scientists that say we have until mid-century for human beings, that's still not a long time, and that's still not enough time to make societal changes. That might be why governments and leaders of non-governmental organizations and corporations are not making any of those changes, because it's too late. It's been too late for a while, and some people are in positions that they know it's too late, and they've been in those positions for a while. So I suspect if we're going to effectively shut down nuclear power plants, for example, there's nearly 450 of them around the world, we need to shut them down safely in order to ensure human existence on the planet out beyond their decommissioning. we would also have to deal with climate issues at the same time, meaning we would have to collapse industrial civilization as quickly as possible. Doing those together seems ridiculous at this point because it takes so much industrial activity to decommission those nuclear power plants. It also takes 10 years or more to safely decommission them. So it looks like we've painted ourselves into a real corner here as civilized human beings. And I don't see a way out. We've triggered those dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops you mentioned at the top of the show. And as near as I can tell, 11 of those 12 are irreversible. We can't turn them around. They just keep going faster and faster. We can get on a treadmill, but there's no way to outrun climate change, not at the level we've triggered it at this point.
That was Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson on The Gary Null Show on May 14, 2013. Find it on PRN.fm. Before we go into the science of near-term human extinction, let's get a different view, this time from John Michael Greer.
The Pleasures of Extinction? That's the title of a blog post in the middle of May by John Michael Greer. He's known as the Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, but also as the author of over 20 books. Here are titles of just three that might interest you. The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, The Ecotechnic Future, Exploring a Post-Peak World, and The Wealth of Nature, Economics, As If Survival Mattered. From Cumberland, Maryland, John Michael Greer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So the 2012 end of the world, it was kind of a dud, and now you think we've got a new replacement to worry the popular mind?
Well, there had to be a replacement. The thing is, the apocalypse fad, the apocalypse meme, as I called it in one of my other books, is very much a constant factor. People are always looking for something to justify doing nothing, to justify sitting around, because after all, the world's going to end and take care of it. We had Y2K, if you look back over your entire lifespan, somebody was getting very deeply into the idea the world was going to end next week. There are many Harold Campings among us, so there was guaranteed to be something once the whole 2012 thing blew over. And I think we've gotten it now. We're starting to hear a lot of stuff in the blogosphere about near-term extinction.
Right. Well, I sort of missed a little bit of that. Who is Harold Camping?
Oh, Harold Camping was the guy earlier in 2012, I think. He was a Christian minister who predicted the rapture was going to happen May something or other. And it was a big media thing. Some people donated a lot of money to him. He had billboards all over the place announcing that, the rapture was going to happen. He calculated out some complex thing in the Bible, and then, of course, it didn't happen. And he simply revised the prediction for sometime in October. And then it didn't happen again.
Well, the whole Seventh-day Adventist church is based on that. I hate to say it, and so are a bunch of other churches, that it's gonna end right away.
It's any day now. Any day now for the last 2,000 years.
Why? Why do we humans have this perverse hope the world will end, preferably while we're around to see it happen? Some people are disappointed they died before it happened.
Oh, it's a really complicated thing, and there are many different reasons why people, I think, fixate on this apocalypse meme, this notion that we're the big generation, we're the ones who are going to see all the fireworks go off. But especially in times like these, times when there's a lot of trouble, there's a lot of economic crisis, there's all kinds of pressures and a lot of reason to think that we can no longer keep on living the way we're used to living. I think it's very easy to say, well, the world's going to have to take care of that. I don't have to get rid of my SUV. I don't have to, look at retooling my life to actually live within the limits of a fragile planet. No, no, no. The world's going to end. Don't worry about it. Pedal to the metal, baby.
Well, isn't there a fundamental difference, though, between scientific measurements that some of these near-term extinction people are claiming and Christian belief in the end times?
Well, of course, to a certain extent there is. But the problem is that these scientific concepts are being pulled out of context. These are hypotheses, okay? They're speculations. They have some numbers behind them. They are very uncertain. I think of the argument being made by, I've forgotten the guy's name, Light, I think his last name is, who has this theory whereby methane buildup over the poles will do X, Y, and Z and cause all life to be extinct by X period. It's an interesting hypothesis. It's an interesting speculation. Does the fact that somebody has said this might happen mean that it will happen? No, of course not. But people are presenting it as though this proves that we're all going to die. And that's where we take the leap away from science and into the apocalyptic mythology.
for a while there, the peak oil movement was also predicting a big crash, and we were all going to go primitive, like James Howard Kunstler's world made by hand. Why didn't that happen?
No, the thing is, the peak oil scene was and remains very diverse. There are people in the peak oil scene who are very much into next Thursday we're going to be in the Stone Age. There are people in the peak oil scene all the way on the other spectrum who are saying, you know, this is our opportunity to make that great leap into green technologies, blah, blah, blah. Then there's kind of the mainstream of us who are saying, no, actually, we're in a world of hurt. We are facing a long, difficult, grueling time as we retool our expectations and our societies for a world where we have a lot less energy and a lot fewer raw materials than we used to. And one of the reasons that the whole overnight collapse thing has in the peak oil scene has been kind of fading out is precisely that those of us in the mainstream, those of us who are saying, no, it's just a world of hurt. We're facing, you know, to use the title of my book, The Long Descent. We've been making predictions all along, and our predictions have been right. We were predicting years ago that, you know, the price of oil was going to ratchet upward to levels that economists said were completely impossible, $100 a barrel. There were people not that long ago who were insisting that that can't be achieved. By the time it reaches that, this society will crash in flames, blah, blah, blah. That didn't happen. But the other side, the people like Daniel Yergin, who were insisting that oil was going to hit a permanent plateau of $38 a barrel, that didn't happen either. So the peak oil scene is, again, the main currents of it have really tended to focus on something more realistic, not the world is going to end, but the world is going to change in some very difficult, challenging, hard ways.
Well, John Michael Greer, you have your own vision of the downfall of industrial society, which you call catabolic collapse. What is that, and why is it different from climate-driven extinction, for example?
Well, actually, it incorporates climate-driven decline. Now, obviously, the main difference is that climate-driven extinction assumes that by some point, I think the usual NTE claim at this point is like 2030 or 2045, there will be no human beings left alive anywhere. I'm not saying that. It is perhaps possible that might happen, but it's far from probable, and it would be completely unrealistic to claim that it's certain. So catabolic collapse is based on the idea that as a society runs short on resources, including energy, it starts feeding on itself. It starts cannibalizing its own infrastructure, and it starts scrapping things that in its unessential services. It starts basically just feeding on itself. That's what catabolism means. And so, in effect, it devours itself in the process of collapsing. Now, one of the reasons I developed this theory is precisely that this is what we see when we look at how other civilizations have collapsed in the past. They've kind of fed on their own infrastructure, their own internal resource base, until there was very little left. And so my proposal, the catabolic collapse proposal, which is, again, not certain, it is simply my proposal as to what the most likely process is that we're going to see a period of between 1 to 3 centuries of ragged decline, various crises on regional, local, national, global scales, sort of like stumbling down or falling down a staircase, not like falling off a cliff, so it's sort of thump, 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 down you go, over between 1 and 3 centuries and ending in a dark age.
This is Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex Smith with author and commentator John Michael Greer. Getting back to that idea of near-term human extinction, how do you see that developing in the echo chamber of the Internet? Will it be strong enough to affect some people's life decisions?
I think it already is, and in a variety of ways. The question is very much whether it catches the imagination of more than a few people, and that's really hard to predict. It's like hula hoops or you know, any other fad. But I think there's a lot of people, now that 2012 isn't around anymore, who are looking for a reason not to deal with the future, who are looking for a reason not to face the challenges that we actually do face. And near-term extinction is a great way to do that. You can simply say, oh, well, we're all going to die anyway. Who cares? Let me go burn a few dinosaurs. Or whatever. I mean, there are various things that people might do in response to that, but I don't think most of them will be productive. It's, you know, it may be this, it may be something else. Maybe we will all, there will be this big announcement that the Earth's going to be devoured by a giant space walrus or something.
You know, it's so strange. You write about America's preoccupation with what sociologist Philip Lamy called fractured apocalypses. Why is there so much more of this in America than in other countries, do you think?
Well, you have to remember that Europe exported all of its religious kooks to the United States. That's what we call American immigration. For hundreds of years, from the time that the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts, all the way up until about the beginning of the 20th century, all kinds of religious groups, from Europe were taking ship, coming over here, and in Europe was just waving and saying goodbye, have a great time. So we ended up with religion as a primary organizing principle over here in America, when in most of Europe it's an irrelevance. So we've got all of those people who were, you know, who were deeply, we got the descendants of all those people who were very, very deeply religious, who left Europe, who left wherever, to settle someplace where they could pursue their religious vision. And so we've got this weird society where, on the one hand, we've got the tradition of freedom of religion, where people can practice whatever religion they want to. On the other hand, we've got this sense that religion is very, very important in our culture. And so it feeds all kinds of religions, all kinds of secular quasi-religions, all kinds of sort of religious thought and secular drag. The singularity is a great example. It's the rapture dressed up in science fiction.
Right. So, John Michael Greer, you are heading off to the Age of Limits conference. What will you be talking about there?
I'll be talking, first of all, about progress as a mythology, as a religious belief. The way that belief in progress has been the most important religion of American life for many years now. And that now that progress is coming to an end, we need to start looking at how we're going to organize our lives and understand the world in a world after progress. That's one thing. The other thing that I'll be talking about is the way that some of the old systems of community organization that were practiced in the United States before the beginning of our imperial age of excess and abundance, how some of those may be useful tools for organizing local community in the deindustrial age that's coming upon us now.
And you've taken some heat for connecting that near-term extinction meme with things like the Y2K computer crash. What are people saying?
You bet I'm taking it. Well, the thing is, it's just like speculative bubbles. Everyone wants to say this time it's different. This one, my apocalyptic faith is not the same as all these other apocalyptic faiths, even though it's basically the same thing, using, you know, slightly different cherry-picked factoids to justify it. Okay, big deal. It's the same narrative. The song remains the same, even though it's a different verse. And so, you know, people have been flying off the handle. There's been a lot of emoting. And that's fine. That's fine. I'm hoping that at least some people stop and look at the near-term extinction thing and look at the factual basis behind it, which is really rather frail, and say, okay, well, here are these worst-case scenarios. Okay, I got that. We've stacked up a whole bunch of worst-case scenarios, and if all of these horrible things happen, then maybe possibly humanity will go extinct. Okay, that's cool. I get that. That doesn't mean we should all just kind of sit down and fold our hands and go, oh, whoa, we're all going to die.
Okay, well, is there anything you would like to add as we wrap up here?
As we wrap up, I would say the important thing is that thing from The Life of Brian. You remember when Brian was shouting to the crowd, "You must all think for yourselves," and they all shout back, "Yes, we must think for ourselves," in perfect unison. Let's get past that. Thinking for yourself does not mean following something you read on the internet, even if I'm not, and I include my blog in that. I want people to ask their own questions, to come up with their own answers, to think through things like, okay, here are these cherry-picked worst-case scenarios. What does this actually mean? And to go through that and think through that and then say, okay, what am I going to do about all this? How am I going to change my life to deal with the future that I see coming toward us? And if more of us do that, I think we'll accomplish much more in the world.
Well, you've made me smile a couple of times, and I needed that. We've been chatting about Ultimate Things with John Michael Greer. He's a prolific commentator, speaker, and author of more than 20 books. Check out The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, for example. John Michael's posts are regularly at the archdruidreport.blogspot.ca, or find that link in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John Michael Greer, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Greer was heavily criticized by those who believe near-term human extinction is inevitable and is a scientific point of view. When I raised the danger that all sorts of end-time seekers and tinfoil hat types would pile on board this new idea, participants in the near-term extinction discussion site, yes, that's already online, they said, of course, we know that, but that doesn't change the science behind what we are saying. So let's look at that science. In his seminal post on June 20th, 2012, titled We're Done, Guy McPherson links to this quote from Malcolm Light, quote, "This process of methane release will accelerate exponentially, release huge quantities of methane into the atmosphere, and lead to the demise of all life on Earth before the middle of this century," end quote. McPherson has defended Malcolm Light and the Arctic Methane Emergency Group in various places, including Transition Voice, the organ of the transition movement. Now remember, I'm not questioning McPherson's other sources, including Utah Professor Tim Garrett, the International Energy Agency, and a long list of others. I've checked those, and Guy is right. They are frightening predictions of warming up to 6 degrees centigrade or more by 2100, a climatic catastrophe for sure. I'm concerned about the conclusion that we will be wiped out soon, and especially using Malcolm Light of the AMEG group as a source. Malcolm Light's core article, posted on the Arctic Methane Emergency Group website, is titled, "Global Extinction Within One Human Lifetime as a Result of a Spreading Atmospheric Arctic Methane Heat Wave and Surface Firestorm." In what looks like a scientific paper complete with complex graphs and charts, we find this stunning announcement, quote, "The absolute mean extinction time for the Northern Hemisphere is 2031.8 and for the Southern Hemisphere is 2047.6, with a final mean extinction time for three-quarters of the Earth's surface of 2039.6, end quote. Well, that's pretty precise, isn't it? On August 2031, say goodbye for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. There is a lot in this article. I won't call it a scientific paper until I can find evidence it was peer-reviewed or published in an official journal. This theory and the radical solutions I'll discuss in a minute were presented to Britain's Environmental Audit Committee. The UK Parliament responded to this all-party committee's report, Protecting the Arctic. This AMEG paper went well beyond the fringe into serious consideration by a major government. We get slightly different estimates of when humans will go extinct in notes to one of the complex graph in Light's article. It reads, quote, "Figure 8 shows a different method of interpreting the extinction fields defined by the 12 plus 3 plus 6% year-long lifetime of methane, IPCC 1992, assumed to have been instantaneously injected into the Arctic atmosphere in 2010, and the lifetime of the globally spreading methane atmospheric veil at the different methane global warming potentials. The start of extinction begins between 2020 and 2026.9, and extinction will be complete in the Northern Hemisphere by 2057. Extinction will begin around 2024 in the Southern Hemisphere and will be completed by 2087. Extinction in the Southern Hemisphere, in particular in Antarctica, will be delayed by some 20 years. This makes property on the Trans-Antarctic Mountains of premium value for those people wish to survive in coming methane firestorm for a few decades longer." I'm sorry, but I find that a little bit laughable. Let's pick up on that key phrase, assumed to have been instantaneously injected into the Arctic atmosphere in 2010. That leads to the building block of the whole theory and the panic to geoengineer the planet. An unlikely source has disputed this essential point. Somewhere out there in cyberspace, there is a person who made tens of thousands of posts on the site democraticunderground.com. She or he used the name Muriel Volstrangler, which just happens to be an alias used by British comedian John Cleese in a book. Muriel says Malcolm Light cherry-picked the worst single measurement of methane release in 2010, a startling spike reported by the American agency NOAA. It was taken from the Arctic Svalbard base on the day of November 16, 2010. Light uses that spike for all his subsequent frightening calculations. But here is what New Zealand blogger, climate show radio host Gareth Renowden wrote in his Hot Topic blog about the graph Malcolm Light used. Quote, "The graph comes from NOAA's Earth System Research Lab's Global Monitoring Division's new data visualization webpage here. You'll see a CO2 graph first, but click on the menu to the left of the graph to get the methane version. The readings for the last year are preliminary and shown in brown. The last five data points are so far off the chart that they are almost certainly going to be rejected as being caused by local contamination. That's happened before. The green dots show when. And at the moment, other Arctic sites are not showing a similar rise. However, Svalbard is close to sea floor methane hydrate deposits that are known to be venting gas. End quote from Gareth Renouden at hottopic.co.nz. Muriel Volstranger tells us the data points showing the big methane spike have indeed been revised by NOAA, who always said such measurements were provisional. I checked. The spike is gone. The steady rise over the decades is back. You can see it for yourself at the NOAA site. Therefore, most of the calculation in Malcolm Light's paper are not based on reality. They show what could happen, maybe, if there ever was a big release of methane in the Arctic, which continued at the new high level. But that hasn't happened at all. There's no doubt about this. Actual methane levels in the global atmosphere have not spiked beyond the gradual increase we've seen for decades. There is no emergency yet. Muriel writes, quote, "But since the basis for all of it is a one-month anomaly at one measuring station, which has since been counted as a false reading, it is all based on a mistake. He has taken that one-month error and extrapolated it until the world was heated up by 14 degrees C, which he says will therefore be an extinction event." End quote. It's good news if Malcolm's paper is faulty, unless you have an agenda that requires governments to act in panic. Who is Malcolm Light, and what does he want? At AMEG, we find only this. Malcolm Light, specialist in earth sciences, blogger at globalwarminglight.blogspot.com. He claims a PhD from the University of London, but we are not told in what field. I checked that blog address, but Global Warming Light has been taken over by companies selling financial services. It's a dead end. An article at The Ecologist magazine describes Light as an inventor and retired professor. Not much information there. At a post at peakoil.com, Light says of himself, "Malcolm Light, retired Arctic oil, mineral, and climate researcher. Getting closer." I followed up on papers published by Malcolm Light, which he cites in his AMEG posting. It is from the place where Malcolm Light worked, the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas, Austin. He is a petroleum geologist who spent most of his career in Texas preparing information to assist extraction of fossil fuels. In his earlier days, at least, he was never a climate scientist or an Arctic expert. Now we understand the vision that Malcolm Light is advancing to solve the climate crisis, a solution which hardly anyone in the environment community knows about. Digging around on the net, we find Malcolm Light has two main answers for the methane emergency. Other scientists, like David Archer at the University of Chicago, remember, dispute there is any such emergency at this time. The first solution Light calls Project Lucy. I found it at the Iowa City Climate Advocates site. In this paper, Malcolm Light gives himself a new description. Quote, "Malcolm Light, PhD, University of London, consultant with many years of experience in methane, diamonds, and numerous related topics." End quote. Here is Light's solution number one. Quote, "Project Lucy therefore aims to design, build, and test a microwave transmission system targeting low-altitude methane clouds with the aim of breaking the first C-H bond as soon as the methane erupts into the atmosphere from the Arctic Ocean. The transmitters can be mounted on submarines, planes, and after 2015, on boats and drilling rigs when the Arctic ice cap has melted." End quote. Light also calls for the use of HARP, the High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, super radio wave broadcasting facility in Alaska, to break up methane. He wants to use the multi-billion-dollar secret military facilities in both the United States and Russia to emit a very specific frequency. Not only will this break up methane into less harmful chemicals, Light claims, it will create a byproduct of nanodiamonds, tiny flecks of diamonds in the upper atmosphere, which would serve to reflect more sunlight away from Earth. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Malcolm Light bases this whole radio waves kills methane and makes diamonds theory on experiments in making artificial diamonds under high pressure in laboratories. No one has ever tried what he suggests in the open air. So far, I can't find a scientist who can make any sense out of this proposal in the real world. Perhaps someone could try it and see if anyone would fund the research. At least, I like the idea that radio will save the world. That matches my own hopes with Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Malcolm Light's second way to save the world from the alleged Arctic methane emergency is far more dire. Characteristic of the answer seen by a petroleum geologist or big fossil fuel companies, his solution is to install a massive array of gas drilling rigs in the Arctic, trying to capture methane from the sea and land before it can rise up into the atmosphere. This second plot has the delightful name the Angels Project. I found this in a PowerPoint presentation by Light titled, A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane. ANGELS is an acronym for Arctic Natural Gas Extraction, Liquefaction, and Sales. The subtitle reads, A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane-Induced Catastrophic Global Climate Change by Extraction of Methane from Beneath the Permafrost, Arctic Methane Hydrates, and Its Storage and Sale as a Subsidized Green Gas Energy Source. A green gas, indeed. Shell Oil, ExxonMobil, Statoil, and all the majors will be thrilled to hear we must start drilling for natural gas in the Arctic right away or go extinct. Light continues, quote, After 2015, when the Arctic Ocean becomes navigable, it will be possible to set up a whole series of drilling platforms adjacent to, but at least 1 kilometer away from, the high-volume methane eruption zones, and to directionally drill inclined wells down to intersect the free methane below the ceiling methane hydrate permafrost cap within the underlying fault network, end quote. He predicts huge methane plumes erupting from certain identifiable areas of the Arctic Sea, from troubled areas of the seabed. These should be capped instead by drilling rigs and the energy used in place of oil or coal. Quote, Separated methane is stored in LNG tankers for sale to customers as a subsidized green alternative to coal and oil for power generation and for air and ground transport. It will also be used, he says, for home heating and cooking and the manufacture of hydrogen, fertilizers, fabrics, glass, steel, plastics, paint, and other products, end quote. And here is how the world will be convinced to burn this Arctic methane, quote, Support should be sought from the United Nations, World Bank, national governments, and other interested parties for a subsidy, such as a tax rebate, of some 5% to 15% of the market price on Arctic permafrost methane and its derivatives to make it the most attractive LNG for sale compared to LNG from other sources. This will guarantee that all the Arctic gas recovered from the Arctic methane hydrate reservoirs and stockpiled will immediately be sold to consumers and converted into safer byproducts. This will also act as an incentive to oil companies to produce methane in large quantities from the Arctic methane hydrate reserves. In this way, the Arctic methane hydrate reservoirs will be continuously reduced in a safe, controlled way over the next 200 to 300 years, supplying an abundant green LNG energy source to humanity, end quote from Malcolm Light. So, we will run the world from the Arctic methane erupting from clathrates and permafrost melting. Global warming will force us to capture this massive source of greenhouse gases and convert our society to methane power. Forget about solar or wind power, tidal, or simple changes to drastically reduce our power use. We'll turn lemons into lemonade as the Arctic warms. We'll spray sulfates too, Light says, using aircraft to cool the Arctic, and hope those radio waves create some reflective nanodiamonds into the upper atmosphere to further deflect the sunlight. It's a total industrial solution to the woes of industrial civilization. Think about this for a moment or two. As I say, we are forced to extract and burn still more climate-wrecking fossil fuels or go extinct, according to Malcolm Light. But we have only a limited amount of carbon we can still burn and stay below 2 degrees, other scientists say. I doubt there's enough left in that budget even to build and install this fleet of Arctic drilling rigs. No such Arctic drilling has been tried. Shell Oil's attempt last year turned to disaster when they tried to withdraw their rig before winter. It crashed aground in Alaska. Beyond that, we haven't a clue whether the methane will really appear mainly along certain fault lines shown by Malcolm Light. None of that research has been done. Does anyone really believe we can capture meaningful amounts of methane from a geologic release occurring across the vast Arctic tundra and the coastlines tens of thousands of miles long? The whole world economy would have to be converted to drilling rigs to capture a tiny percent of the methane. It doesn't make sense. Adding it up, it's a huge and possibly dangerous fantasy with near-term human extinction absolutely nowhere in sight. The UK government responded to the Environment Audit Committee's report by saying they do not envisage an ice-free Arctic in the next few years or a collapse in the major ice sheets on Greenland anytime soon. The government wrote, quote, "Geoengineering techniques for the Arctic at present do not offer a credible long-term solution for tackling climate change. Further research is needed to understand how such techniques work and their wider impacts on climate systems. In the meantime, therefore, we remain unconvinced that using technical fixes is the right approach, and efforts should not be diverted from tackling the fundamental drivers of global climate change," end quote, from the British government. Denied. There are all sorts of curiosities lurking around in the AMEG plan to save the Arctic and the world. They suggest the move away from burning dirty bunker fuel in ships is a mistake. Ships should burn the dirtiest, most sulfur-laden fuel we can find to add more sun-deflecting clouds. Commercial aircraft, they suggest, should get fuel additives that create chemtrails to ward off the sun. Unbelievably, they use the word chemtrails, thus setting off another whole internet hive of paranoia. In fact, I think a case can be made that Malcolm Light's paper does two things. It creates a story to bring the public and maybe even environmentalists on board for massive gas drilling in the Arctic. That's something big oil and gas companies want very badly. But it also stirs up noise level around climate change, which may be just as important to the major energy companies. As University of Chicago climate scientist David Archer told us in a Radio EcoShock interview, once the public becomes over-concerned about methane coming from some faraway Arctic place, we can forget about our own roles in burning carbon every day in our cars, homes, factories, and power plants. It's carbon dioxide that really counts in the long run. Carbon dioxide, not methane, will determine the heat of the world for the next 100,000 years, for millennia after the short-lived methane has broken down. Let's hear a few words from David Archer on Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
And again, some scientists and journalists who interview them are worried about methane from the Arctic could cause a runaway greenhouse effect. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane, to me, what those words would mean is that you get some warming from some methane, which then causes more methane to come out, which gives you more warming, so a positive feedback in that sort of a cycle. But because methane breaks down so quickly, it's very hard to get as much radiative forcing, as much climate oomph out of methane as we are already getting from releasing fossil fuel CO2. So the response of climate to the methane is fairly muted unless it was just a huge release. And then you also would need the methane melting to respond very quickly to changes in the climate in order to have, you know, a feedback. And, you know, yet you look around at how methane comes out and all of those sources are slower than the lifetime of methane in the atmosphere. They don't respond instantaneously or within a year or two or something like that. They respond over centuries. And so I don't see the potential for a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane, but I do see the possibility that methane in ocean hydrates and carbon that's frozen into permafrost soils could eventually release carbon to the atmosphere that would add to the cumulative effect from all the CO2 that we've been releasing. So the methane wouldn't have much effect on climate in the next, you know, decades, but hundreds of years from now, the carbon from methane and from permafrost soils could be sort of like matching funds or something, that we put in so much carbon from fossil fuels and then the Earth throws in, you know, an amount that sort of matches what we do or something like that. So that would affect not the peak of the warming, but rather the long tail, which with CO2, as we talked about last time, 2 years ago, affects the climate for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years into the future.
Well, the most catastrophic proposal that I've heard comes from Shakova, who says that there are 50 gigatons of methane gas as bubbles underneath the sediments on the Arctic shelf, the Siberian shelf, which could all come out all at once. And I don't know if I believe that the sort of slow warming that is happening there could trigger all that to come out all at once. You need some sort of a trigger, like some huge earthquake or something. But if it did come out all at once, there's a interactive model that I published on my webpage that you can play with and see what happens. If you put in 50 gigatons of methane all coming out in a year, you can compare the climate forcing, the radiative forcing, the energy imbalance caused by that methane. You can compare that against the radiative forcing from fossil fuel CO2. And what you'd find is that the forcing from the methane after a big burp like that would be much bigger than the forcing is today from fossil fuel CO2. But it would go away in a couple of decades. And by the end of the century, the forcing from fossil fuel CO2 will be higher even than the methane spike was at its worst. So it almost seems to me like it would be a chance for humanity to sort of try it before we buy it for keeps with CO2. Might not even be such a bad thing at that.
So there you have it. Maybe a good burst of methane and a climate shock is what we need to bring humanity to our senses, to make us finally get out of denial and act. It's a horrible thought, but nothing else has worked so far. That was climate scientist David Archer, author of the book The Long Thaw and an editor at realclimate.org. We talked on the Radio EcoShock show February 15, 2012, as part of my survey of three scientists, including AMEG's Peter Wadhams. Find links to all of that in my blog at ecoshock.info. Perhaps in the next few decades we will see a significant burst of methane from the Arctic. It's something that should be monitored much more. We should spend $1 billion on research to determine the real level of threat from the frozen methane in those shallow seabeds and from melting permafrost on land. I've done several Radio EcoShock shows about all of this and will continue to do so. I think AMEG has done some good work. We've had great interviews from ice expert Dr. Peter Wadhams from Cambridge and Paul Beckham from the University of Ottawa. Paul taught us all about the jet stream, the latest science. I hope to have him back as a guest. But I think the article by Malcolm Light is flawed. It may be based on faulty data and unproven assumptions. At this point, it's nothing more than an interesting idea in the realm of science fiction. We may very well experience a methane emergency in the Arctic. It's possible without the work of AMEG, we might not be watching as we should. Let the group carry on. But without the histrionics about near-term extinction of humans and reassessing their roles, assisting big fossil fuel companies, whether intended or not. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith, saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. I can't do a show on human extinction without saying that other very serious scientists, public policy wonks, and artists are still deeply concerned about it. As we learn more about biology, it's apparent that all species have gone extinct sooner or later. You may recall my interview with Dr. Peter Ward about the Medea hypothesis, that all forms of life are ultimately self-destructive. Find that on our website or with a Google search. In last week's program, I considered one argument for our survival, that some humans will continue to live directly from nature, even if our complex world falls completely. We heard from National Geographic author Scott Wallace and his book The Unconquered. If you missed that, download it from our website, ecoshock.org. In a future Radio EcoShock show, we'll hear other ways of facing ultimate threats to our humanity from the author of a new book,
titled Sustainability and Well-Being. As I read through my review copy, I was startled to find author Asoka Bandaraji says some humans are already going extinct. In fact, the Aboriginal people we were counting on may be the first to disappear. Here's a reading from that new book, recorded for Radio EcoShock by Asoka.
Extinction is not a phenomenon restricted to non-human species. Some scientists state that as a result of human dominance over the Earth, we have entered a new Anthropocene era, that is the current geological period where human activities are shaping the global environment. It could well be speculated that our very dominance is now moving us into a post-Anthropocene age of human demise. Given the intimate connection of their livelihoods to their ecosystems, indigenous peoples worldwide are most vulnerable to climate change, destruction of biodiversity, and chemical pollution. During the course of European colonization, the world's tribal population was reduced anywhere from 30 to 50 million between 1780 and 1930 due to conquest, the spread of new diseases by the Europeans, and sometimes outright extermination. In 1500, there were an estimated 6 to 9 million indigenous people living in the tropical rainforests of Brazil. In 1992, less than 200,000 remained. The few last remaining indigenous tribes are being fast extinguished across the world. A cautionary example is the Boa, one of the 10 great tribes of the Andaman Islands east of India's mainland. In February 2010, with the death of its last remaining member, the Boa and their 65,000-year-old language, which is traced to pre-Neolithic times and the first human settlement of the region by African migrants, disappeared forever. Like the Boa, who faced habitat destruction, poverty, and disease, all other Andaman tribes, especially the Jarawa, inundated by mass tourism, are also expected to disappear soon, along with their languages and cultures. UNESCO has reported that during the past 300 years, there has been a dramatic increase in the extinction of languages, and that 3,000 or more languages still spoken in the world are seriously endangered. A research study from the International Diabetes Institute at Monash University in Australia also warns that if the diabetes epidemic attributed to changes in diet and lifestyle is not halted, many indigenous people, including Aborigines in Australia, the Maori in New Zealand, Pacific Islanders, and Native Americans, could become extinct by the end of the century. Indigenous people are not the only ones victimized and made dispensable in the process of economic integration and cultural homogenization of the world. Many other groups are experiencing ecological and economic collapse and loss of livelihood.
That was Asoka Bandaraji reading from her book Sustainability and Well-Being, published by Palgrave. Perhaps we can only go extinct if we accept that as our fate and refuse to change our ways. Our last clip comes from 2005 by author and longtime Sacramento journalist John D. Cox. Cox was speaking at the launch of his book Climate Crash, Discovering Rapid Climate Change and What It Means to Our Future. He brought up one of the few cases of extinction in our recent history, namely the Viking settlement on the coast of Greenland. They were hit hard by climate change as the times became colder.
I think there are all kinds of institutional constraints against adaptation. Modern societies have property right issues and all kinds of ownership issues and real estate issues and other regulatory issues that in infrastructures that depend on storm tracks arriving at a certain place, and you know, so the water supply is stable. There's all kinds of things that invest us in stability. So I think if there's going to be instability, if there's going to be some kind of, you know, rapid change, almost to the point of a public emergency situation, you know, where growing areas or, you know, agricultural areas are no longer going to get sufficient water, et cetera, you have to be able to sort of think outside the box and you know, and do things, be prepared to do things on a, you know, at a different level than you might otherwise do. I think we should do everything we can to avoid such a thing happening. And if it still happens, you know, we're going to have to be prepared to do things that sort of unthinkable things about changing certain habits. You know, there's an interesting corollary to some of this in a way, and that is in the 10th century, the first European settlement in the West was created by the Norse in Greenland, and it was an entirely successful colony for the better part of 400 years. And then it died out. And there's a, you know, it's an interesting story about how climate changed up there abruptly. And suddenly it just, you know, as the old, you know, the anonymous author said, you know, it got cold and they died. Well, you know, they've looked into that with the ice core work and the isotope work that they've been able to do with some really detail now. And they've also, you know, this interdisciplinary approaches have looked at this question, you know, more thoroughly. You know, the Greenland, Norse Greenland colony, this European colony, failed at the very time that the native Inuit was thriving in that condition. You know, why did the Norse fail and the Inuit thrive? It's because they didn't adapt. You know, they were unable to change their culture to adopt, you know, successful technologies that the Inuit employed for, you know, for hunting seal. You know, they had these skin boats that were able to just pick up over the ice and slide along and put them back down in the water. You know, it was just this sense of this culture identity that permitted that allowed the Norse to choose extinction in a sense over the adoption of the culture of the pagan Inuit that they despised. You know, there is a case of adaptation failure. You know, we look at it now and say, well, those fools, you know, it was right there. All they had to do was you know, adopt the, you know, the hinged harpoon and that kind of thing, like the Inuit had. All they had to do was change their boats, that kind of thing. Well, you know, we'll see. I mean, some of the resistance that we see at the political level, this is kind of the song that we're singing to ourselves about whether we're adapting or not. You know, I mean, we can all decide how successfully that's going, but in a way, it's, you know, it's like the old Norse. You know, they decided that they weren't going to change by God. They were going to keep their ties to the church, and they were going to, you know, continue the everything European that they could think of. And you know, there you are.
In the recorded speech, Cox questions the idea that climate change can be reversed with reductions in emissions, or that we can fix it, or that it will be a slow progression. You can find that video on C-SPAN or the link at ecoshock.info. Will we choose extinction, even when more natural ways of survival are known, are there right before our faces? Are we too inflexible to survive? Too wedded to the many fossil fuel-powered slaves we all enjoy, from cars to dishwashers and vacation flights? As John Michael Greer suggested, we may bump down some hard stairs for a few hundred years. I expect plenty of mass die-offs, a decrease in human population, and forced climate migrations. But in 2050, I think my grandson will be alive, and despite all, he'll be glad to be alive. That is the way we are. Please support Radio EcoShock if you can at our website at ecoshock.org. I ask you to educate yourself to the challenge by listening to our scientists and authors in past shows. You can get them as free MP3 files on our site. Support your local nonprofit radio station, please, so we can stay on the air. I'm Alex Smith. Don't give up to near-term extinction thinking. Use our wit, love, and persistence to change the paradigm, and don't be afraid to have fun while you're doing it. Thank you for listening.
So if you want your kids to survive and not drown in the ocean,
oceans rise. It'll be like that one apocalypse film we watched last night. Oh wait, they're all the same. Everyone dies. So if you want your kids to survive and not burn up when the temperatures rise, ashes to ashes we all fall down. Unless we take the steps to turn it around, you've got to think.